Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me is the lusciously maned David Griscom. David, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm sure everyone's very excited for today's segment. A white guy from the Midwest and a white guy from Texas talk about the Jewish question.
We're going to get down to it. We're going to drill down deep. Yes, it is an exciting episode where we're going to maybe get ourselves canceled talking about if Mark should be canceled. This is it's a very interesting text, actually, and shall I say unfairly maligned, but we will actually talk about, you know, some of the attitudes that Marx had about Jewish people that were problematic, but we'll get into the full nuance of it also. But the first thing I want to say about this is, so one, the first part of it, which is the part we're going to focus on today, is extremely good defense of Jews and their rights to be politically, to be full citizens politically. In the context, and what's so interesting about this is, so this is we're in Marx's early career. This is actually a text from the formative early writings of Marx from Audible is what we're going to be playing, and he wrote this in, I think, 1843 and published it in 1844. I'm seeing around those dates. And that is about when I got into this business. And it's about, David, I don't know, when did you start? How old were you when you started at TMBS?
What? Was 5 years ago. So I must have been around like 24, 25.
Yeah. So like the mid-20s, right? Like that, yeah. Marx would have been about 25, 26. And it's so interesting to what is being dealt with here is this is a response to a guy named Bruno Bauer, who was saying that Jews first need to liberate themselves from their religion before they can be seen as full citizens politically, basically. And this reminds me a lot of, you know, one of the early sort of reasons I was drawn to Michael's work particularly, which is people saying this about Muslims, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how can you be part of a, like, Jordan Peterson going over to meet with Viktor Orban to talk about, are Muslims even compatible with democracy? This is a very old, old argument. And again, Marx, in his brilliance, in the, you know, goes right to the material factors of this. Then there is a part two that we'll get to that confounds a lot of this, because it's, I would just to characterize it briefly before we get into part one, is it's Marx, yes, anding. And he's maybe too comfortable doing so, caricatures about Jewish folks and money. And he's doing it to make a point about Western civilization in general and the sort of like money-grubby nature of that itself. And so we'll talk about a little bit about that. We have a guide text for us today. It's a really good book called Karl Marx, Philosophy and Revolution by Shlomo Avineri. It's part of Yale University Press's Jewish Live series. So now, Karl Marx was not culturally Jewish. His father converted to Christianity. It's unclear if it was right before Marx was born or pretty much immediately after. Avineri suggests that there's more evidence suggests immediately after. So Marx was born to Jewish parents. Both of Marx's grandfathers were rabbis, so very much like a descendant of Jewish folks. And it's unclear, there's not a whole lot of evidence how conscious this conversion was in the Marx household. Imaginably a touchy subject, but it's just like, who knows? But imaginably, but Avineri suggests like there would have been some consciousness of it there. And he suggests that some of the heat that he responds to Bauer with is that he feels this sort of personally. And so you can have a guy, Avineri suggests, where, you know, he does, and in a private letter we'll get to at the end of this, suggests, you know, anti-Semitic or traffic in anti-Semitic language and tropes. And he's also a guy who descended from Jews himself. And like that, so it's the 19th century, you know, race science also bubbling up. You see a lot of that. So with particularly with the letter about Ferdinand LaSalle, which is again a private letter. But is there anything you want to jump in here with, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're obviously being, you know, sensitive and making sure that people are aware around some of the controversies that especially come up later in this text. And obviously, like, you know, people immediately when you hear somebody debating these kind of, this like a question of any group, you know, you should obviously be, you know, a bit suspicious and questioning as to what the motives and the purpose of this is. And like the reason that this text is actually very worthwhile, right? The reason that we're spending time on it is because it's a very, very powerful critique actually of one, you know, kind of dominant ideologies held by people in Germany at that time. Two, a critique of the kind of liberal way to get around this problem, which was essentially to follow, you know, kind of like maybe potentially an American style, you know, system where you have a separation of church and state. And Marx is actually very critical about that. And we'll get into that later, because it actually is a very, very important, you know, distinction there. And I think lastly, you know, just like about the text, it's like, you know, we obviously, you know, people understand the history of why, you know, hearing like the Jewish question is something that should, you know, worry, right? It's like, it's something that we know how that ends in that society. But these are questions that are asked constantly in democracies, right? About certain kinds of groups, right? They're asked about, you know, Black people in America after emancipation and incorporation into American society. And in fact, those are still very much asked today, right? Like, what is the problem with this community, right? Can they fully assimilate into like the value system and all of these, you know, these supposedly neutral institutions, right? Like, these are questions that, you know, the right particularly is constantly bringing up. And the reason that this criticism that Marx makes of one, like the most overt kind of exclusionist mentality, but two, of this kind of, you know, religion blind, and then we could even maybe extract this to American society, like race blind, multicultural, like liberal answer to this problem, is also very, very limited as well. And like what we need to do, you know, spoiler alert, according to Marx and most communists, is to eradicate the conditions that create these kind of separations in society in the first bit. But we'll get into all of that as we go. And if I may, like, I just wanted to add a little bit of like history of philosophy context here too, as Matt went over when this was published. But, you know, this and what we did earlier with some of Marx's earlier writings, like, these were not a very big part of like the Marxist canon. You know, so when you read people like Trotsky or Lenin or Kautsky or Luxembourg, right, they weren't reading these texts because these weren't really, they weren't disseminated in this way, right? Like, you know, Marx, one, because of the time that Marx was writing in and the fact that, like, you know, he became a much bigger figure after death. You know, his earlier writings really started bubbling up, particularly in like Western Europe and in the United States. And I don't think this was translated into English until something like the 50s or 60s, right? You know, so this is something, it is worth noting too, that like this was something that became like a kind of, held a special place for kind of radicals in the 50s and 60s. I mean, it's also notable that so many of them, you know, at this time, this is also when we see this like turn to culture from material politics. And, you know, just to give people who might not be familiar with the history there, you know, like, more orthodox Marxists, particularly people like Louis Althusser, who, like, you know, we can maybe discuss how to think about him or to interact with his work later. But like, if you want to look at somebody who like really tried to make the Marxist system in the way that was sort of put forth in Capital, like, work on its own two feet without really reconstructing a lot of it, it's like, it's Althusser. Like, Althusser is like the Marxist Marxist. And, you know, he calls, you know, these texts as the immature Marx. And it's very clear here, because you have to remember to the history of this thinker, you know, Marx discovers later through his analysis and his scientific work, like his critique of capitalism, right? Like the things that we're going to import onto this text as people who like are familiar with Marx's later works, you know, it's a little unfair to bring those back in a way. Like, you can see that Marx is sort of clawing toward them, but we don't have the kind of like sober scientific analytic Marx that you get in his later work here. Like, as Matt was saying, this is fresh-faced 27-year-old sort of working through some ideas in front of all of us. So it's just worth noting there as well that, you know, it's not that you can't read these in conversation with like the later Marx, but just understand that, like, I would argue too that there is definitely a delineation between earlier Marx's work and his later work.
Yeah, yeah. And one other note I wanted just say about Bruno Bauer here. We talk about like those where these ideas went, like on the Jewish question, for instance. Mm-hmm. Bauer went on to support like Bismarckian expansion and wrote a text saying like Jews are basically aliens to Germany, right? So like Marx was very much on the right side of this question. 100%.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the most important thing to underline here, right? Like,
and just like, again, you know, because I would imagine this might be a longer video, you know, mm-hmm. we'll talk about that stuff a lot more at the end when it's pertinent. But, you know, the point here to make too is that, like, you know, I think that you don't have to fall into a trap of defending Marx's really, really horrific metaphor that he uses in the second bit, and we'll go more in depth about that later. But the point that is worth noting, as Matt was saying, like Bauer, who he's arguing with, ends up supporting like hyper reactionary, hyper violent movements. While Marx, like intervention in all of this in Germany was in fact like extremely progressive, and that doesn't mean that you're forgiven for all of the the things that you're saying in private letters and things like that.
Give Marx a free pass.
But it is worth noting that if we're understanding this as like a bit of intellectual history, that this is like the countervailing force to like the unfortunate hyper reactionary forces that are going to end up dominating Germany over the next century.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, and like I said, this comes from read by Derek Lepage. It's on Audible if you have that application. It's decent reading. But as we've pointed out in the previous episode, different translations of Marx will come up with different things. And there's one instance here where he mentions the census and what he means and what I got the is this Marxist.org.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got that one. And it's actually, the property requirement for the franchise. So like,
it's pretty big.
Like, right. I mean, Jesus. Anyway, so we'll try to step in here if there's any egregious ones like that. I've made a few notes. I think that's the main one that I noticed. But awesome. Here is that reading. I feel like this layout might be. Yeah.
On the Jewish question. By Karl Marx. The German Jews crave for emancipation. What emancipation do they crave? Civic, political emancipation. Bruno Bauer answers them, quote, "Nobody in Germany is politically emancipated. We ourselves are not free. How shall we liberate you? You Jews are egoists if you demand a special emancipation for yourselves as Jews. As Germans, you ought to labour for the political emancipation of Germany, as men, for human emancipation, and you ought to feel the special nature of your oppression and your disgrace not as an exception from the rule, but rather as its confirmation. Or do Jews demand to be put on an equal footing with Christian subjects? Then they recognise the Christian state as justified. Then they recognise the regime of general subjugation."
Again, just to clarify, this is him characterizing Bruno Bauer's argument.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe that is going a little bit fast. I can't go the normal speed because I'm
working. Yeah.
Why are they displeased at their special yoke when the general yoke pleases them? Why should Germans interest themselves in the emancipation of the Jews if Jews do not interest themselves in the emancipation of Germans?
Hmm.
The Christian state knows only privileges. In that state, the Jew possesses the privilege of being a Jew. As a Jew, he has rights which a Christian has not. Why does he crave the rights which he has not and which Christians enjoy? If the Jew wants to be emancipated from the Christian state, then he should demand that the Christian state abandon its religious prejudice. Will the Jew abandon his religious prejudice? Has he therefore the right to demand of another this abdication of religion? By its very nature, the Christian state cannot emancipate the Jews. But, adds Bauer, by his very nature, the Jew cannot be emancipated. So long as the state is Christian and the Jew is Jewish, both are equally incapable of granting and receiving emancipation. The Christian state can only behave towards the Jew in the manner of a Christian state, that is, in a privileged manner, by granting the separation of the Jew from the other subjects, but causing him to feel the pressure of the other separated spheres, and all the more onerously, inasmuch as the Jew is in religious antagonism to the dominant religion.
And I just want to say, you know, just to underline the point, like when Marx's father converted, that was in a period of intense reaction. So Napoleon, the Napoleonic French Revolution, the progressive forces of that, led to a more acceptance and political, basically extension of political rights to Jewish folks. And then you get, my understanding, the Congress of Vienna and a basically aristocratic reaction once Napoleon was defeated. And all that stuff gets thrown out. So that's why you see this wave of conversions, particularly like Rhenish, the Rhineland, the Rhine is the river there, of Jewish folks there. And so like this is a very urgent question.
And it's very, very likely, you know, by the way, as you were alluding to, that like the conversion also could have I mean, most people probably argue would be forced in these contexts, right? Like, you know, this is not necessarily something of somebody willing, it's somebody recognizing that like they're going to get certain kind of rights and abilities to assimilate and participate in society in a different way than other folks, right? So I think most people would consider that to be a forced conversion. I think most people probably can get the flavor of it without knowing the history, but you know, it is also worth remembering that this is a period of time where like the German state is Christian, and not in the way when we talk about the American state, and we'll get, Marx talks a lot about the U.S. later, which is actually very interesting, but like,
yeah,
not in the way of like the U.S. where like, oh, well, there's a Christian majority in the country. It's like, no, like, you know, the state, the way that it interacted with its subjects was very, very much rooted in theological defenses for the powers that be. There are different rights and different systems for people depending on their faith, right? Like this is not, you know, the kind of multi, you know, faith society that we sort of understand most Western democracies to sort of occupy today, right? And it's really important to recognize that. So that's when Brunner, when Bauer is saying like, you know, like Jewish people have special rights and privileges given to them by the society, which is a pretty impressive way to spin that, I must say. You know, what he's saying there is that like, you know, they get treated specially by the government. And, you know, again, I don't think it's helpful to make it a one-to-one argument, but like you can see how, you know, there are lines like this that exist in other facets, you know, in contemporary American society too. It's like, oh, this group gets special privileges, you know, what do they want from us? Right.
He's an Enlightenment bro, right? He's like, you didn't do your rights of man. And Marx gets into this explicitly. Mm-hmm. You didn't do your rights of man thing, so you know, go do that first and then talk to us, right? Like that's basically what he's saying. And Marx points out, like, I mean, yeah, that's the America stuff is great, because you know, I like that Marx's interest in, you know, those examples, and America, place that doesn't have a state religion, very explicitly against that, and Marx points out still very religious, but we're skipping a little bit ahead.
Yeah, let's keep going. So again, and just remember, this is Bruno, still Marx characterizes Bruno.
Yep.
But the Jew also can only conduct himself towards the state in a Jewish fashion, that is, as a stranger, by opposing his chimerical nationality to the real nationality, his illusory law to the real law, by imagining that his separation from humanity is justified, by abstaining on principle from all participation in the historical movement, by waiting on a future which has nothing in common with the general future of mankind, by regarding himself as a member of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people as the chosen people. Upon what grounds, therefore, do you Jews crave emancipation? On account of your religion? It is the mortal enemy of the state religion. As citizens? There are no citizens in Germany. As men? You are as little men as he on whom you called. unquote. After giving a criticism of the previous positions and solutions of the question, Bauer has freshly posited the question of Jewish emancipation. How, he asks, are they constituted? The Jew to be emancipated and the Christian state which is to emancipate. He replies by a criticism of the Jewish religion. He analyzes the religious antagonism between Judaism and Christianity. He explains the nature of the Christian state, and all this with boldness, acuteness, spirit, and thoroughness, in a style as precise as it is forcible and energetic. How then does Bauer solve the Jewish question? What is the result? The formulation of a question is its solution. The criticism of the Jewish question is the answer to the Jewish question. The summary is...
And so he continues. I think that's a good point to stop with his you know, laying out of what Bruno is saying there. Bruno.substack.com.
I mean, there's definitely a vibe there. And like, look, I mean... I think it's also, you know, people, if you hadn't already watched it, you know, we did a video on Marx's criticism of Hegel's philosophy of right. And like, this is again, like, you know, again, remember, like, Marx was running with this crowd in a way, you know, philosophically at least. And he broke for them pretty dramatically. And he hasn't completed his break, it should be noted. You know, he's breaking from them right now. He's seeing where a lot of this shit ends. But primarily, I mean, like, you see how so much of the content of the criticism or like the way that they can even think about the Jewish question, right? Which, again, like, you know, remember, you know, that's any kind of question is by itself an exclusion, right? Whenever you ask it, like, you're excising those people from any kind of national or social whole. But beyond that, when they're talking about this, like the young Hegelians, Bruno Bauer and all of them, like, they can't escape thinking about it in terms of like, what is like the teachings or ideology of Christianity? Where are the teachings or ideology of like Judaism, right? Something that as we go on, like, Marx is very, very much going to sort of start pushing up against, you know, this way of thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just one other note, you know, we talked about Marx.
You know, wait, episode. I'm sorry, but man, I don't mean to cut you off, but are you frozen on your screen too?
No, I'm not. Should okay.
I think if you're frozen? Not frozen on your screen, then it should be fine in the cloud. I just want to make sure. You keep on freezing on me.
Okay, let's just
that's why that. I keep on moving all the things.
Oh, really?
Refresh
okay.
You, yeah.
Yeah, well, I hopefully will be all right. Otherwise, you might just get my frozen bug, you know, doing stuff. But
well, you're thinking it, at least on my end. You're like,
yeah. Oh, one other thing I wanted to note. So, Marx at Berlin University, which we discussed in the Critique of Pure Reason episode, where he studied under a guy. I think Edward Gans is his name. I'm looking for my note on that. But anyway, this is a guy who also had to convert. And it's unclear if – and Gans was somebody who had a relationship with Hegel. Hegel was relatively progressive on the Jewish question, I guess, as it were. And so Marx was familiar with that's who Marx was exposed to Hegel by, in fact. So yeah, let's go a little bit further with this. Is where Marx starts talking about what kind of emancipation is needed.
And it exists no longer. Page 66. On the one hand, Bauer states that the Jew must abandon Judaism and that man must abandon religion in order to be emancipated as a citizen. On the other hand, he feels he is logical in interpreting the political abolition of religion to mean the abolition of religion altogether. The state, which presupposes religion, is as yet no true, no real state. At any rate, the religious idea gives the state guarantees. But what state? What kind of state? Page 97. Unquote. At this point, we are brought up against the one-sided conception of the Jewish question. It was by no means sufficient to inquire, who shall emancipate, who shall be emancipated? Criticism had a third task to perform. It had to ask, what kind of emancipation are we concerned with? Upon what conditions is the desired emancipation based? The criticism of political emancipation itself was only the eventual criticism of the Jewish question and its true solution in the general question of the time. Because Bauer does not raise the question to this level, he falls into contradictions. He posits conditions which are not involved in the nature of political emancipation itself. He suggests questions which his problem does not imply.
This sort of thing is why I like Marx. Like, he goes on little tears like this, and he can really, like, slap up an opponent paragraphs like this.
And he solves problems which leave his questions unsettled. Whereas Bauer says of the opponents of Jewish emancipation, their mistake was that they assumed the Christian state to be the only real state and did not subject it to the same criticism that they applied to Judaism, we find Bauer's mistake to consist in the fact that it is only the Christian state and not the general state that he subjects to criticism, that he does not investigate the relation of political emancipation to human emancipation, and consequently lays down conditions which are only explicable from an uncritical confusion of political emancipation with general human emancipation. When Bauer asks Jews, have you the right from your standpoint to crave political emancipation? We would inquire, on the contrary, has the standpoint of political emancipation the right to demand of Jews the abolition of Judaism, or from men generally the abolition of religion? The complexion of the Jewish question changes.
Because I think that this is a very critical and key argument that Marx is making. And I also think, you know, going back to the controversy of, you know, this entire text is actually, like, very, very important here, right? When he's – because essentially, like, if I were to paraphrase what Bauer's argument is here, is that you can't ask for special treatment. The only way that we can get past this, you know, tension is for us, for particularly Jewish people, and because Bauer also argues later, I don't know if we'll go through it here, Bauer basically argues, you know, kind of like evolutionary theology, right? And that Judaism is like at a lower stage of theology than Christianity.
Yeah.
So he argues that, you know, this is Bauer's argument, is like, you know, Judaism needs to, like, get to the Enlightenment essentially, so that we can eradicate religion, right? And only then, you know, can we get this emancipation of Jewish people and also of Christian people by making the state, you know, essentially a secular one. And what Marx says right there is, I think, very, very important, you know, where he starts to ask about if we even have the conditions or ability to really pursue that kind of politics right now. And I think I want to wait till we get to the American example to really break all this down. But I just wanted to note that Marx, you know, pushing back against Bauer's argument, essentially, was just like, well, you just should leave your religion behind, is completely insufficient. Even if you might see that, like, there's some kind of progressive nature in Bauer's argument that, like, well, the state shouldn't be religious, right? You have to also recognize that what Bauer is effectively arguing is that, like, you know, drop your tradition, drop your religion, you know, or else shut up, you know, which is, you know, again, not to make too many contemporary analogies here, but it's something that you also see when certain people get excised or asked questions about if they can really assimilate into our apparently, you know, open and, you know, open democracy, right, that doesn't assert any kind of belief or person, right? It's supposed to be a neutral system, but as you see in the American context, it's not the case, right?
Right.
Generally, the abolition of religion. The complexion of the Jewish question changes according to the state in which Jews find themselves. In Germany, where no political state, no state as state, exists, the Jewish question is a purely theological question. The Jew finds himself in religious antagonism to the state, which acknowledges Christianity as its basis. This state is theologian ex professo. Here, criticism is criticism of theology, is two-edged criticism, criticism of Christian and criticism of Jewish theology. But however critical we may be, we cannot get out of the theological circle. In France, in the constitutional state, the Jewish question is the question of constitutionalism, of the incompleteness of political emancipation. As the semblance of a state religion is there preserved, although in a meaningless and self-contradictory formula, in the formula of a religion of the majority, the relationship of Jews to the state retains the semblance of a religious and theological antagonism. It is only in the North American free states, at least in part of them, that the Jewish question loses its theological significance and becomes a really secular question. Only where the political state exists in its completeness can the relation of the Jew, of the religious man generally, to the political state, and therefore the relation of religion to the state, be studied in its special features and its purity. The criticism of this relationship ceases to be theological criticism when the state ceases to adopt a theological attitude towards religion, when its attitude towards religion becomes purely political. The criticism then becomes criticism of the political state. At this point, where the question ceases to be theological, Bauer's criticism ceases to be critical. In the United States, there is neither a state religion nor a religion declared to be that of the majority, nor the predominance of one cult over another. The state is alien to all cults. Marie ou l'esclavage aux États-Unis, etc., by G. Beaumont, Paris, 1835, page 214. There are even North American states where the Constitution does not impose religious beliefs or the practice of a cult as a condition of political privileges. Loco Citato, page 225. Yet, nobody in the United States believes that a man without religion might be an honest man. Loco Citato, page 224. Yet, North America is preeminently the country of religiosity, as Beaumont, Tocqueville, and the Englishman Hamilton assure us with one voice.
It's interesting to note, like, he's reading Tocqueville. You know, just I just like those sorts of notes, just to know what what you said, like, because we said at the top this was published in 1844, right? But like you mentioned, not really disseminated widely, and I don't even know, like, in Germany, right? Like, how widely are these things really collected? And then Engels doing a lot of work, I guess we'd have to figure out what he was up to, but like not a century later in America. And right there is, you know, Tocqueville was a splash in his day, I guess.
I mean, Tocqueville, I mean, yeah. And Tocqueville, honestly, we should do some stuff on Tocqueville one day, too, because, you know, that's absolutely fascinating text. But, yeah, I mean, I also think that this is like, you know, and again, like, sometimes these texts, you have to go through them a few times to really have them, you know, be clear to you. And this format can work for some and it's more difficult for others. I just wanted to say, like, you know, effectively, what Marx is saying here is that, like, you know, all of this kind of high and mighty talk that you're even getting from, you know, even these progressives, right, you know, by their standards of the day, that, like, well, we should, if we change the nature of the state to be a secular, non-religious state, then, you know, this question will go away. Marx is actually saying, well, that's a very interesting idea, but if you look at America, that's not the case at all, right? And there's a big part of the kind of political and legal culture in the U.S. To, you know, to have that separation between church and state. But that has not meant that, you know, that religiosity has gone down, nor, you know, this the things that you're sort of the emancipation of, for example, Jewish people or like religious minorities in that society, that has not been the case either in the Americas. So Bruno's right. Like kind of, you know, thesis here that we can, you know, we could potentially get through it if people stop believing in God. Okay. you know, but primarily so Jewish people stop being Jewish is what he really means there. And then the second bit of Bruno's argument is like, and then if we change the Christian state, that will also change the nature of it. But Marx is making this really important Marxist point, and this is where you can start to see Marx clawing at what is going to end up becoming, you know, dialectical materialism, his great historical theory, is this recognition that this kind of neat separation between rights and spheres of society is BS. So that if you notice, like, Marx makes the difference between political emancipation and human emancipation, right? That's a very important point. What he means by that is, in the American state, we experience this, right? We are all equal before the law. Yet some are more equal than others, right? Well, a great example of this is, even though we all supposedly have the right here to go and if we're charged with something, you know, we go and we're judged by a jury of our peers. There is no right or privilege given to a rich man or somebody because of their status or their family or whatever, right? Which very much did exist in Europe, and it was a good break from that. But look what happens if you're a rich guy versus a poor person in the American legal system. If you're a poor person, you're going to get a public defender who's completely swamped. And if you're a rich person, you're going to get a guy who's going to cost you a lot of money, but he's going to pretty much be able to get you away, you know, out of any jam that you're in. Or, you know, if you do get caught, your sentence and punishment will be very much less so than anybody else would get in that kind of circumstance, right? So we have political freedom in America in that sense, right? In the sense of, like, neutral before the law. But we don't have economic freedom, and that's a contradiction between these principles, right? And the same thing goes into religion. And we got more to get to, but it's like, this is why this text is a very crucial and powerful one, because Marx is one, criticizing, I think, a kind of reactionary view from Brunner, but even in trying to build it up to knock it down, is showing why that's also an extremely insufficient argument. You know, too, that, what we just need is a realization of the Enlightenment, in the sense of, like, you know, American values brought to Europe. You'd be making a mistake.
And it's funny, like, that question, like, when it ceases to be theological, Bauer ceases to be critical. It's like, Bauer's literally describing the, like, argument against his own shit, and he doesn't realize it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Marx continues here. This next section is really good.
Meanwhile, the North American states only serve as an example. The question is, what is the attitude of completed political emancipation towards religion? If even in the country of completed political emancipation we find religion not only existing but in a fresh and vital state, it proves that the existence of religion does not contradict the completeness of the state. But as the existence of religion indicates the presence of a defect, the source of this defect may only be looked for in the nature of the state. We are no longer concerned with religion as the basis, but only as the phenomenon of secular shortcomings. Consequently, we explain the religious handicap of the free citizens from their secular handicap. We do not assert that they must remove their religious handicap as soon as they cast off their secular fetters. We do not transform secular questions into theological questions. We transform theological questions into secular questions. After history has for so long been dissolved in superstition, we dissolve the superstition in history. The question of the relation of political emancipation becomes for us the question of the relation of political emancipation to human emancipation. We criticize the religious weakness of the political state by criticizing the political state in its secular construction, apart from the religious weaknesses. We transmute the contradiction of the state with a specific religion, like Judaism, into the contradiction of the state with specific secular elements, and the contradiction of the state with religion generally into the contradiction of the state with its general assumptions. The political emancipation of the Jew, of the Christian, of the religious man in general, means the emancipation of the state from Judaism, from Christianity, from religion generally. In its form as state, in the manner peculiar to its nature, the state emancipates itself from religion by emancipating itself from the state religion, that is, by the state as state acknowledging no religion. Political emancipation from religion is not a thoroughgoing and consistent emancipation from religion, because political emancipation is not effectual and consistent human emancipation. The limit of political emancipation is immediately seen to consist in the fact that the state can cast off a fetter without men really becoming free from it, that the state can become a free state without men becoming free men. Bauer tacitly assents to this in laying down the following condition for...
And I think that will actually take us to kind of our next part, where he talks about the limitations of the revolution, the Enlightenment revolutions, basically, right? And he already hinted at it with the America thing, saying like, well, clearly this didn't get rid of religion. It actually caused it to thrive and flourish. So what are the causes if we accept that religion is a defect? And it's a different, there's still an alienation that exists. And he basically goes to critique those as bourgeois revolutions. And that's the alienation that's causing that, you know, need for religion, as we saw in the opium of the people, you know, mm-hmm. section in the Critique of Pure Reason. So let's skip a little bit ahead here. And he goes over and talks about how Hegel mentions, I think, about America that, you know, the more religions you have, one can't be dominant. It's like, I guess, you know, add an NBA expansion teams or something like that. But anyway, I don't know. and that's a Friday metaphor for you. Here is where he continues about a little bit about religion in America and bourgeois revolutions.
Question of the separation of the individual from his community, from himself, and from other individuals, what it was originally. It is only the abstract profession of special perversity, of private whim. The infinite splitting up of religion in North America, for example, gives it outwardly the form of a purely individual concern. It has been added to the heap of private interests and exiled from the community as community. But there is no misunderstanding about the limits of political emancipation. The division of the individual into a public and a private individual, the expulsion of religion from the state into bourgeois society, is not a step. It is the completion of political emancipation, which thus neither abolishes nor seeks to abolish the real religiosity of the individual. The splitting up of the individual into Jew and citizen, into Protestant and citizen, into a religious person and citizen, this decomposition does not belie citizenship. It is not a circumvention of political emancipation. It is political emancipation itself. It is the...
I mean, that's a pretty, like, amazingly progressive formulation.
Absolutely.
There, right? Like, that actually, these are signs of progress. That, and I mean, you still get people complaining about, like, hyphen Americans, right? Like, that sort of thing. Yeah. And what I like about this too is, like, I think Marx is good at having both, like, what's good about, you know, political emancipation, why it's necessary to extend it to folks, and why it's also limited historically in getting, like, full, as he calls it, human emancipation.
Absolutely. I mean, this is like that, and that's also like, that's dialectics in a nutshell. I mean, we were roasting James Lindsay in the show earlier this week for, like, not understanding that concept, but, like, that's the real dialectics. Again, it's not just smashing different concepts together. It's recognizing, you know, that some preconditions might be necessary for future conditions. And to be able to push those future conditions forward, you, like, need to be critical of, like, the immediate, for example, like, political revolutions that you're seeing around you. You know, and not supporting them in a kind of, like, this is like the tension, though, is like not supporting them in the sense of, like, you know, just sort of being a partisan of kind of very short-sighted political movements, but recognizing that, you know, okay, well, these tensions and these movements that are happening in society create, you know, the groundwork for this, like, actual full human emancipation, right? The need of the expansion of, like, bourgeois revolution, liberal rights to the vast majority of people in society is a very necessary precondition for human emancipation, or at least that process needs to be pushed as far as it can until it hits that wall that will sort of necessitate the vast majority of people in society, pushing back against it. But again, like, this is Marx, like, before he has his great scientific breakthrough in Capital, really starting to sort of claw at these limitations of liberal right versus, human emancipation.
Right.
Political manner of becoming emancipated from religion. Moreover, in times when the political state as a political state is forcibly born of bourgeois society, when human self-liberation strives to realize itself under the form of political self-liberation, the state is driven the whole length of abolishing, of destroying religion. But it also proceeds to the abolition of private property, to the law of maximum, to confiscation, to progressive taxation, just as it proceeds to the abolition of life, to the guillotine.
Which is like, this is the part that Jordan Peterson and all the people that want to talk about the bloodthirsty Marx, right? Like, that's a critique of, like, shit, we can't go except but the maximum of, like, chopping heads off and progressive taxation, which is interesting. I don't know what – I'd be curious to know, because all I know about progressive taxation is America was the first to do it because of the Civil War. And so I'm curious what, like, the sort of debates around that stuff were, but that's an interesting section there.
Yeah, I know progressive taxation in the U.S. too, like that. Also, there's like a political, like there's a map that most people understand it to be. I mean, like, Marx, they talk about this, heavy taxation on the rich in the Communist Manifesto as like the original platforms of communist society. So, I can only assume that this is what he's starting to grasp at. It's sort of like taxation with like the intention of liquidating, private property and the rights, the economic
right.
power that some people have in society. I think that that's what he must mean by that.
Right, right.
I mean, we're staying in this section, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
In the moment of its heightened consciousness, the political life seeks to suppress its fundamental conditions, bourgeois society and its elements, and to constitute itself as the real and uncontradictory generic life of the individual. It is, however, only enabled to do this by a flagrant violation of its own conditions of life, by declaring the revolution to be permanent, and the political drama, therefore, ends as inevitably with the restoration of religion, of private property, and all the elements of bourgeois society, as war ends with peace. Why, not even the so-called Christian state, which acknowledges Christianity as its basis, as the state religion, and therefore adopts a prescriptive attitude towards other religions, is the completed Christian state. The latter is rather the atheistic state, the democratic state, the state which consigns religion among the other elements of bourgeois society. The state which is still theological, and which still officially prescribes belief in Christianity, has not yet succeeded in giving secular and human expression to those human foundations whose exaggerated expression is Christianity. The so-called Christian state is simply no state at all, because it is not Christianity as a religion, but only the human background of the Christian religion, which can realize itself in actual human creations. The so-called Christian state is the Christian denial of the state, although it is not by any means the political realization of Christianity. The state, which still professes Christianity in the form of religion, does not yet profess it in the form of the state, for its attitude towards religion is a religious attitude. It is not yet the actual realization of the human basis of religion, because it still operates upon the unreality, upon the imaginary shape of this human kernel. The so-called Christian state is the incomplete state, and the Christian religion is regarded by it as the complement and the redemption of its imperfection. Consequently, religion becomes its instrument, and it is the state of hypocrisy. The so-called Christian state needs the Christian religion in order to complete itself as a state. The democratic state, the real state, does not need religion for its political completion. It can rather do without religion, because it represents the realization of the human basis of religion in a secular manner. The so-called Christian state, on the other hand, adopts a political attitude towards religion and a religious attitude towards politics. If it degrades the state form to the level of a fiction, it equally degrades religion to a fiction.
I think that's a good place to take off there.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say about that section?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is where we're really starting to get to it with Marx here, and again, why this text is a very important one. Because, you know, going back to what we were talking, you know, to the critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, when Marx criticizes religion, again, as people, as the heart of the heartless world, right? You know, it's the sign of the oppressed creature. You know, what is really meant by that? And what is he talking about when we're talking about, you know, religion? Religion is an alienated form of community, right? In this way of thinking about it, right? There is a human condition and a human need to contribute and to be social and to be part of society. And what you see in the construction of liberalism in particular is all of these tensions of, you know, supposedly the end of the iron fist and the iron rule of you know, just naked power over us to a much softer kind of ideological rule and political rule, you know, that we sort of understand to be, you know, modern democracy. And religion has always been a way that an alienated people are able to realize, you know, the sense of community, right? Like what religion, you know, when people talk about, like, well, you see this all the time from people in America today, even, right? Like, drop the church. Like, people say, like, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual, right? And, like, frankly, what they mean by that is they want to have some sense of community and history and participation in something grander than themselves as an individual, but something that is very, very much denied to us in our day-to-day life, right? Because of capitalism, because of all of the different, you know, groups that we also, you know, consider ourselves to be a part of, you know, like, you know, so like that's like the critique. But where Marx radicalizes it and where this criticism goes further is not what Bauer or like these kind of early atheists do, right? Where they say, like, well, this is false. So if we rid ourselves of the mask, right? If we rid ourselves of, like, you know, superstitious thinking and superstitious beliefs, right? You know, we'll be free. And Marx is saying, like, no, we create religion to fill the alienation that is a consequence of, you know, the property question society, the failures of, like, liberal democracy to be able to realize them. So going so far as to say that, like, we will never be rid of all of those other forms that do, you know, that create these kind of divisions in society until we eradicate the source of that alienation, right? Like, this is a very, very crucial part here. And, you know, for all of this kind of hope that some people had that, you know, moving from a, you know, religious to a secular state would break it. You know, we see in the North American example, you know, that's not the case. And, you know, I just wanted to note, you know, one thing that Marx says earlier when he's talking about North America, right? Is in North America, the practical, what does he say? Oh, whenever there's a bankrupt and the bankrupt trader deals in the gospel, just as the gospel preacher has become rich, goes in for business deals, right? What he's saying is that, like, if it's good business, if you're bad at business, to go into religion. And if you're good at religion, you should go into business there, right? And so the point is that, like, there has been no kind of, like, weakening of, like, the need or, you know, allure of religious thinking and religiosity just because the state doesn't play this strong role in it. But it is, like, the very, very fundamental conditions of, you know, capitalism, you know, that do create the need and the space for religion, maybe for different reasons, right? Because you're not necessarily trying to attach yourself to the state as a religious figure, you know, the same way you would maybe in Germany. You know, but the sense that there is, like, a reward, for example, for you to do that is certainly there. And for the people who have the lack in society, there is a kind of spiritual personal reward that they experience as well. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and look at like the other, if you, we can widen the scope out to, you know, the, to folks that frankly weren't even seen in Rheinische Zeitung, the magazine that Marx wrote in, slaves, right? Like we know like American slaves, like their religiosity and what that meant communally for those folks. And it did, imagine, you know, saying, okay, slaves, you want to be free, but, you know,
yeah,
you got to get that religion stuff up first. Yeah, it'd be crazy to say.
Yeah, and again, it's just like, this is like the dance, right? Whenever you start to hear people say like, well, we have like a religious self versus a political self, or even, and this is where Marx, like, this is where this transcends the religion question. This is where it transcends it as a sense of like, you know, in what they're talking about in Germany, like this tension between civilian life and private life, because effectively what you get in liberal democracy is, you know, those two worlds, you know, supposedly being separate as a kind of peace. And that's, you know, that does not, you know, eradicate necessarily like the tensions of, you know, of religion, society in society, saying like, well, you have your personal beliefs at home, right? And then you have to have these public beliefs in the public square, right? There's an alienation there. I'm not even saying which one is right or wrong, but there's an alienation if you are living your life one way at home and you have to conduct yourself differently in public and vice versa, right? And yeah, what Marx is trying to get at, and what the kind of hope of this project is to eradicate the conditions where that distinction is necessary in the first place, so that we don't have to be alienated in these different spheres. And most importantly, we don't have to be alienated you know, in the economic sphere, right? I think that's one where most people listening to this program would understand more than anything, right? You live in a democracy, you live in a free society. When you're walking on the street, you're as equal as me. But once you come into my factory, I'm the boss, you're the worker, you need to do what I'm said. And like all of that kind of equality and democracy and all these things that we are taught since we're kids, that withers away very, very quickly, right? And that creates alienation. And in the same way, you know, so does this kind of private public distinction too, that has sort of been the truce of like liberal democracy, creates alienation as well. So we have to eradicate the tension, the source of the tension, you know, if we ever want to deal with that properly. Right.
And here's this last chunk we'll play here. We get into Marx gets into the conclusions and more about the rights of man, sort of, you know, bros. So get into that.
Religious variety. We have therefore shown political emancipation from religion leaves religion in existence, although not as a privileged religion. The contradiction in which the supporter of a particular religion finds himself involved with his citizenship is only a part of the general secular contradiction between the political state and bourgeois society. The completion of the Christian state is the state which professes to be a state and abstracts from the religion of its members. The emancipation of the state from religion is not the emancipation of the real individual from religion. We do not therefore tell the Jews with Bauer, you cannot be politically emancipated without radically emancipating yourselves from Judaism. We tell them rather, because you could be emancipated politically without entirely breaking away from Judaism, political emancipation is not human emancipation. If you Jews desire to be politically emancipated without emancipating yourselves humanly, the incompleteness, the contradiction, lies not only in you, but it also resides in the essence and the category of political emancipation. If you remain enmeshed in...
I mean, that's like a civilization level version of the "it's not your fault." What's that movie? Is it "It's Not Your Fault"? Is it the Matt Damon movie? You're muted, by the way. I need to look that up.
What, said, I don't know. What, I don't know it.
It's not your fault. Let's see. Oh yeah, Matt Damon and Robin Williams. where your own was, it's not like it's not in you that, you know, you have the a religion issue. It's these fucking conditions, right? And that is like still the dominant, you know, mode of discussing these sorts of issues by, you know, say capitalist media and world empires.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been touching on all of the aspects of how Marx is sort of breaking through here, but this you know before, but like this is exactly like where the Bauer argument is just so limited, right? It's not that what Bauer is essentially saying is like, well, if you guys would just stop being, you know, pesky and having like your own separate religious beliefs, things would, you know, we wouldn't have tensions or problems in society. Marx is going so much further and saying like, if you just seek, you know, political emancipation, like, you know, we can, that can actually be done. But when we're talking about human emancipation, like the real, like the fire that gets people, you know, worked up about this, when you give people speeches, you know, on a subject like this, I'm just thinking of myself as like an organizer, right? You're giving someone a speech on something like this, you know, you wouldn't go through like the procedural aspects of society, right? That like could potentially be enjoyed if there was political emancipation, you know, for folks, right? You would talk about like, you know, like the human nature to be seen as an equal, to be seen as like someone else, right? To be humanly emancipated, right? To experience human emancipation. Like you would be speaking to something that is so much far beyond what would be reached by, you know, political emancipation. And the point again is not to deny the political emancipation. Marx is actually saying like, you know, like that can 100% be done, but this fire and this kernel that's in this demand, you know, it actually requires a much larger jump and step and movement, you know, to be realized.
Right.
Contradiction lies not only in you, but it also resides in the essence and the category of political emancipation. If you remain enmeshed in this category, you share in a general disability. But if the individual, although a Jew, can be politically emancipated and receive civic rights, can he claim and receive the so-called rights of man? Bauer denies it. Quote, "The question is whether the Jew as such, that is, the Jew who admits that by his very nature he is compelled to live in everlasting separation from others, is capable of receiving and conceding to others the general rights of man. The idea of the rights of man was first discovered in the last century, so far as the Christian world is concerned. It is not innate in the individual, it is rather conquered in the struggle with the historical traditions in which the individual has hitherto been brought up. Thus, the rights of man are not a gift from nature, not a legacy from past history, but the price of the struggle against the accident of birth and against the privileges which history has bequeathed from generation to generation up to now. They are the result of education, and can only be possessed by those who have acquired and earned them. Can they really be claimed by the Jew? So long as he is a Jew, the limiting quality which makes him a Jew must triumph over the human quality which binds him as a man to other men, and must separate him from Gentiles. By this separation he proclaims that the special quality which makes him a Jew is his real supreme quality, to which the human quality must give place. In the same manner, the Christian, as Christian, cannot grant the rights of man." Unquote. Pages 19 and 20.
Yeah, I just want to make very clear to people Bauer, that because that was a longer section, that's Bauer, yeah. What Bauer's saying. And Marx is going to respond to that.
Yep.
"The individual must sacrifice the privilege of faith in order to be able to receive the general rights of man. Let us consider for a moment the so-called rights of man. In fact, the rights of man in their authentic shape, in the shape which they possess among their discoverers, the North Americans and the French. In part, these rights of man are political rights, rights which are only exercised in the community with others. Participation in the affairs of the community, in fact of the political community, forms their substance. They come within the category of political freedom, of civil rights, which does not, as we have seen, by any means presuppose the unequivocal and positive abolition of religion, and therefore of Judaism. It remains to consider the other aspects of human rights, the droit de l'homme, apart from the droit du citoyen. Among them is to...
The rights of man versus the rights of citizens, just for the non-French readers there. And that is it. This is an interesting thing, right? When you hear that the rights of man and citizens, Marx points out when they say there's why they say two separate things is we're citizens, the property owners are men, right? And that's, I mean, talk about some, you know, enlightenment for you there.
Be found liberty of conscience, the right to practice any cult to one's liking. The privilege of belief is expressly recognized, either as a human right or as the consequence of a human right of freedom. Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizenship, 1791, Article 10. No penalty should attach to the holding of religious opinions. The right of every man to practice the religious cult to which he is attached, is guaranteed by Clause 1 of the Constitution of 1791. The Declaration of the Rights of Man, etc., 1793, includes among human rights Article 7, the free practice of cults. With respect to the right to publish ideas and opinions...
Cults is, you know, Germans, they're... Yeah. I actually think it's pretty interesting etymologically, like cult, culture, and religion, like these are all... words that are used for the same thing, but it makes a lot of sense, frankly. But yeah, cult is just German for K-U-L-T, men's religion.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And to assemble for the practice of a cult, it is even stated, the necessity for enunciating these rites presupposes either the presence or the recent memory of a despotism. Constitution of Pennsylvania, Article 9, Paragraph 3, all men have received from nature.
Again, this shit rocks. Like, I love Marx just pulling out so the fun, Constitution of Pennsylvania.
The imprescriptible right to worship the Almighty according to the dictates of their conscience, and nobody may legally be constrained to follow, to institute, or to support, against his will, any religious cult or ministry. In no case may any human authority interfere in questions of conscience and control the prerogatives of the soul. Constitution of New Hampshire, Articles 5 and 6. Among the number of natural rights, some are inalienable by their nature, because nothing can take their place. Such are the rights of conscience. The incompatibility of religion with the rights of man is thus not implied by the conception of the rights of man, because the right to be religious according to one's liking, to practice the cult of a particular religion, is expressly included among the rights of man. The privilege of faith is a general right of man.
So this is a Marx out Enlightenment bro in the Enlightenment bro.
Yeah.
Referencing the constitutions.
The rights of man as such are distinguished from the rights of the citizen. What is a man apart from the citizen? Nothing else than a member of bourgeois society. Why is the member of bourgeois society called man, and why are his rights called the rights of man? How do we explain this fact? From the relation of the political state to bourgeois society, from the meaning of political emancipation. Above all, we must record the fact that the so-called rights of man, as distinguished from the rights of the citizen, are nothing else than the rights of the member of bourgeois society, that is, of the egoistic individual, of man separated from man and the community. The most radical constitution, the Constitution of 1793, may be cited. Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, Article 2. These rights, etc., natural and imprescriptible rights, are equality, liberty, security, property. Of what consists liberty? Article 6. Liberty is the power which belongs to man to do everything which does not injure the rights of others. Freedom is therefore the right to do and perform that which injures none. The limits within which each may move without injuring others are fixed by the law, as the boundary between two fields is fixed by the fence. The freedom in question is the freedom of the individual as an isolated atom thrown back upon itself. Why, according to Bauer, is the Jew incapable of receiving the rights of man? Quote, So long as he is a Jew, the limiting quantity which makes him a Jew must triumph over the human quality which binds him as a man to other men, and must separate him from Gentiles." Unquote. But the right of man to freedom is not based upon the connection of man with man, but rather on the separation of man from man. It is the right to this separation, the right of the individual limited to himself.
Freedom convoy.
The practical application of the right of man to freedom is the right of man to private property. In what consists the right of man to private property? Article 16, Constitution of 1793. The right to property is the right of every citizen to enjoy and dispose of, as he likes, his goods, his income, the fruit of his toil, and of his industry. The right of man to private property is therefore the right to enjoy and dispose of his property, at his will and pleasure, without regard for others, and independently of society. The right of self-interest. Each...
You know, I think that's it might be a decent place to start. Yeah. Stop. Like, I think that's sort of the gist of it, right? Like the limitations of actually these revolutions included specifically like property rights. That might explain a little bit why you might see some of the alienation and the effects of it, like religious, alienation continue because you're literally enshrining all that stuff. Yeah.
Undoubtedly. And like, exactly. I mean, this is what we've been, sort of talking about. It's that, this all of these things that Bauer's saying is just completely can be, contradicted and proven as wrong by looking at what the processes are like in other societies. And this kind of, this recognition that like, well, you're so worried about, oh, well, if somebody's, Jewish, they're not participating in the fullness of like German society. Right. But literally like all of these other Enlightenment societies out there that we have, take the position and the role that they take the position very strongly that like, rights are just things that, they're your individual prerogative and it doesn't matter what that relationship is to the, the larger community.
Right. So I guess now we should move on to just characterizing the second part that this is, as you said, David, when you were on the Wikipedia, this is the part that gets most play because it's useful and frankly emphasizing, Marx as an anti-Semite. And I think that's not really fair. Although like he's part of a certain milieu and we'll get to like the worst parts of it. But if you have anything to say before we get into this, Shlomo part.
I think that like, taking this stuff seriously is important. And I like what Shlomo says. So we're, I think we're going to go with that. I'll just say like, there's a pretty wide variation of what folks say, at least to what he's written here in on the Jewish question, the second part. There's some that are saying that like, well, he essentially just is like, really trying to outlogic Bruno and like, these other people to such an extent that he ends up like putting on their clothes in the sense, right? Like he's like really trying to follow through their argument and contradicts it and that he ends up just like incorporating and saying some really, really vile things about, because effectively he starts to talk about like the nature of Jewish people separate from their religion, right? And like, right. That's just like textbook anti-Semitism. And of course the nature is, all the kind of nasty things that are swirling up in German society at the time. I'm just saying like, there's some people who say like, oh, he's just like, he's holding those, he's using this as like this long metaphor, to make another point. I don't find there even to be much of value in the point, even if you were to take that perspective. Right. Like this, like, honestly, you could just like put a pin on it, but he doesn't, so it's worthwhile, being able to work through it.
I was just gonna say, like, I think I had some anxiety around this issue when I was first being exposed to Marx, and I think like it's not like most of the ways it would be discussed in a mainstream publication, I think, would not be super helpful in like getting into this sort of nuance. If you do want more, I do recommend this Shlomo Avineri book. It's part of, like I said, the Yale's Jewish Lives series. And I'll just read from a section here. Most of part two of Zur Judenfrage, that's it sounds worse in German, of course, on the Jewish question, has a totally different tone. Here Marx launches an extreme and sometimes vituperative attack on Judaism. Had he published only part one of his essay, he would be remembered as a champion of Jewish emancipation and equal rights. Part two has largely pushed the liberal political argument of part one into the shadows and gained for Marx a reputation as a hater of Jews. Part two opens with Marx reiterating his main argument against Bauer, that the issue is one of political rights, not theology. Quotes, "Let us consider the real worldly Jew, not the Sabbath Jew as Bauer does, but the everyday Jew. Let us not look for the secret of the Jew in his religion, but let us look for the secret of his religion in the real Jews." Marx doing Marx's stuff again in a direction that is a little bit like, oh, where are we going with this? Yeah. Such a sensible suggestion. This is Avaneri again. Such a sensible suggestion would appear to call either for an analysis of the role of Jews playing contemporary society or of the way their real conditions of life are reflected in their religious beliefs and practices. But none of this follows. What follows is a rhetorically powerful onslaught on Judaism, totally devoid of any real social analysis of what Marx has just called the, quote, everyday Jew, or of Jewish religious precepts. The lines are memorable for their staccato cadences. I'll just read a little bit of them so you can understand what we're dealing with here. What is the secular cult of the Jews? Huckstering. What is his secular god? Money. What, in itself, was the basis of the Jewish religion? Practical need, egoism. The monotheism of the Jew, therefore, is in reality the polytheism of the many needs, a polytheism which makes even the lavatory an object of divine law. Practical need, egoism, is the principle of civil society. Money is the jealous god of Israel. So, you know, you get the picture here. And so here's Avaneri continuing. The more one reads this vehement indictment, couched in almost biblical language, the more it becomes clear that Marx is writing about something beyond actual living Jews. Despite his insistence that one should discuss the everyday Jew, there is no reference to actually living Jewish people or their living conditions. Mm. Similarly, there is no mentioning of their religious practices, the reason apparently because Marx was so totally ignorant of both, never having either experienced them directly or independently studied them. The only reference to any Jewish religious precept is the snide remark that Judaism has, quote, even the lavatory and object of divine law. This alludes to an obscure Jewish practice of thanking the Almighty after any ablution for supplying the human body with orifices, since otherwise human beings would perish. This is a Thanksgiving prayer even the most religious Jews may not be aware of. How did Marx know of it? A fair guess is he probably picked it up in the schoolyard of his Protestant humanistic gymnasium, right? So this is like he's a, in part of it, again, an extremely anti-Semitic culture and a participant in it, right? This is, like we just mentioned, the forced conversions. Yet it is obvious that Marx is aiming at much more than, quote, everyday Jews when he goes on to write, and this is Marx again. In North America, the practical domination of Judaism over the Christian world has achieved its unambiguous and normal expression that the preaching of the gospel itself and the Christian ministry have become articles of commerce, and the bankrupt businessman deals in the gospel just as the gospel preacher, who has become rich, goes for business deals. Shlomo writes, whatever one thinks of this passage, it is obvious that it is not about Jews or Judaism. After all, there were very few Jews in the United States at the time. It is, as he himself admits, about the fact that, quote, money has become a world power. Marx further maintains that it is the Christian world which is the actual realization of what he has just identified with Judaism. So basically, he's playing up the Jewish stereotypes and then throwing it back at Christians. Bold, shall we say. Shlomo quotes a little bit more. And I want to finish with this a few more parts here. If Marx's word on Judaism are harsh, his indictment of Christianity as a source of universal human alienation because of the rule of money is even harsher. Is Marx writing in code? Probably. He ends part two of his essay with the resounding and, in retrospective, ominous words that, quote, the social emancipation of the Jew is the emancipation of society from Judaism. His message is much wider. It is about the emancipation of modern society from the power of money, from capitalism, though he carefully avoids the term. This is not to exculpate Marx or excuse him from the utterly acceptable, unacceptable language he is using regarding Jews and Judaism, but he says similar things about Christianity in the modern world. Given modern European history, Marx's language about Judaism is inexcusable, yet the historical context in which he was writing should not be overlooked. The first point is that if Marx was writing in code, the code was known and understood by contemporaries. In German parlance, Shlomo goes into this was a common thing to do. Even he mentions the Marxist Jewish friend defense, which is a guy, it appears for the first time in Germany in an article by Marxist socialist colleague Moses Hess called On Money, which was published a year later. Unlike Marx, who, as his own essay shows, was quite ignorant of all Jewish matters, Hess, who never converted Christianity, went to an all-Jewish school, knew Hebrew, and was conversant, nonetheless went on to like publish some complete bullshit about, you know, saying that Judaism originated in some sort of the money thing, right? So that's the Marx had a Jewish friend defense. Go ahead, David.
No, I mean, I think that the argument that Shlomo makes is good, and you know, there's like, this is something that people sort of reckon with. And I think that, you know, for people who are interested, I think go and reading that work, and like, there's a whole, you know, host of sources and debate on this that you can get into. I'll just say to my like feelings, it's like, regardless of if like it's code or whatever, I think it's 100% valid to look at this and to be critical of it and to even feel one way or the other about it. But what I was saying to Matt before we went live is just like, well, think about how this is something different from like Winston Churchill's like very, very well documented, you know, like racism, is that, you know, Marx's like actual like participation in society was on the progressive side, not just in his arguments, but like in his politics, right? As Shlomo like notes too, is like, you know, when Marx is invoking things, when Marx is in these debates, like he was very much supporting, you know, progressive, you know, Jewish scholars in politics, and, you know, against these kind of social evils that were very present in Germany, right? Like, had Marx versus like Churchill, somebody who held very nasty private beliefs and also did very, very nasty public things. I guess what, like, to circle back, what I mean by this is, it's like, you know, Marx's like personal beliefs, I think, are very worthwhile to engage with. But when you're looking at something like that, you know, the question is like, what is like the output and like in the work, right?
The public, the public work.
Yeah, and like, so what was Marx doing? Like, if we could find some connections here, or some like movements or things that Marx was doing where he was trying to, you know, promote to make German society more racist or more wicked or anything like that, I think that's very, very valid. Or if he was trying to, you know, starve people like Churchill ends up doing, right? Like, the point is that, like, a lot of times when we're looking into these like views of like historical figures, is to help us explain decisions that they made when they had power, right? And in Marx's case, I think it's very difficult to look at the work, you know, that he was doing and the people he was working with, and to say that like he was out there, you know, promoting, you know, wickedness, like somebody like a Churchill would, for example, or
it's,
you
know, bad.
You come with a million examples. Yeah. Or,
he's literally coming out hard against the sort of lineage that would lead to sort of Hitlerian type extermination. Yeah. And I just want to, like, I mentioned he wrote more on this topic. It was in The Holy Family. Have you heard of this text with Marx and Engels? This is what I hadn't heard of. But published in 1845 with Engels. He doesn't repeat the part two stuff, the style. He cites Jewish authorities against Bruno Bauer, repeats the part one argument, and takes offense to Bauer calling Jews eyesores. The public work, I think, is absolutely clear. Yeah. Now, one final thing I do just want to include, since this is the episode where we're going to like air out Marx, I guess, is this this letter that is the, you know, most famous thing in writing that of Marx expressing anti-Semitism. I mean, I guess besides part two, but this is, you know, this one, there's no, you know, metaphor or thing going on here. This is just like 20th century 19th century race science. But this is talking about Ferdinand LaSalle. After a not very successful meeting in London in 1862, Marx reported to Engels about their disagreements and then reverted to some crass and heavy-handed jocular language, a bit of ugliness that – this is again from Avenari. a bit of ugliness that must have been compensation for his inner rage against a person he considered his intellectual inferior, who nonetheless provided the working class with an enormous organizational and political success. The fact that the comment in a private letter came in a private letter, which decades later would embarrass many socialists and Jewish socialists in particular, does not diminish the nastiness. So I think that is important. Like, this did become a liability for folks. And anyway, here is here's what this section on LaSalle. It is now completely clear to me, as proved by the shape of his, LaSalle's, head and the growth of his hair, that he stems from the Negroes who joined the March of Moses out of Egypt. If his mother or grandmother on his father's side did not mate with a Negro, this combination of Judaism and Germanism with the basic Negro substance must bring forth a peculiar product. So, yeah, you know, it's disgusting. Yeah, condemnatory. And thank God that didn't influence his writing. Beyond that, you know, style in part two, that just nonetheless, again, for the right position for that time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we did it.
I hope that, like, this is, I think the text is, like, it's important to actually reclaim, like, the philosophical arguments here that are very important and worthwhile engaging in. So it's like, it's nice to be able to do that. I hope that was helpful for folks. And also, now you know, so the next time somebody tries to bring up, these things about Marx, the history and the arguments around them, and you can sort of respond intelligently without one waving them away as nonsense, right, and unimportant, but also not letting yourself be kind of manipulated by somebody who might want to use these to try to discredit, fights for human emancipation.
Exactly. Forewarned is forearmed. And yeah, you don't want to get on with this. I mean, we should maybe watch Stefan Molyneux's Karl Marx video, because it's all like Karl Marx, was terrible to his mom and had boils on his face. And
but he said some really good things about LaSalle.
Right. Oddly enough, Molyneux finds a way to condemn that, which is, you would think growth, but it didn't turn out that way. But anyways, folks, we have...
On that, there's some part... Like, this is why those guys are so wacky to me, because, like, no, Marx is not somebody... Like, people aren't interested in Marx because they find him to be some kind of personal virtue, like paragon, right? I mean, this is a guy who was, like... penniless most of his life. You know, the letters he sends to Engels are very funny. But also, if you think about that kind of existence, it's like it's not one to really, want to, follow in that person's footsteps. Again, people don't look up to him because he was some kind of like Robin Hood character, just like scribbling away. But people look up to him because his work really, like, was able to, make clear a lot of the kind of fundamental contradictions in society and also potential ways out of them. So I don't know. It's just funny to hear those guys like, oh, well, I'm going to tell you some things about Marx's personality that you're not going to like. And then you're going to throw away a cap or something like that.
Yeah. And these are the exact same folks who when responding about facts about different historical figures would be like, we can't judge people by the standards
by their time. Today. Yeah.
You know, things were a whole lot different then. It's like, no, the way to judge them is you can do both, like what we just did, right? Like, you can condemn the personal private stuff as that, and you can also make clear like what the actual work is and what the issues of the day were and what the positions meant and where they led to. And I think obscuring part one is doing nobody any favors when it comes to, like, say, an issue like anti-Semitism. And it's bad that we as a culture have allowed that to happen, I think.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, we have some great stuff coming up for you. Patrons, next week we got Wallace Nilambre returning, and we're going to be talking about Ben Simmons and Kyrie Irving, among other things. Excited to do that. So, we'll talk about Colorado Chase Woodruff. Yep. So, see you, stay folks. Tuned. Have a good rest of your Sunday. If you are watching this on day one, like, you better be, because we're very demanding. All right, see you, folks.